Ready?
Let's see what time we got.
The alumni program.
There's good. We can go.
Okay. Hello, folks. Can everybody take their seat? Well, folks, after a year and a half of planning, I hereby proclaim Philadelphia for the next 5 days as the baseball capital of the world. Yay! We're really excited to have you here. I want to thank Sabre for having the wisdom and insight to choose such a great hotel in an absolutely marvelous location, smack dab in Center City, right next door to one of the most cultural institutions in the world, the Reading Terminal Market. You will never go hungry over there, let me tell you.
But if you want to walk the other way, we have a cultural area, real cultural area. We have an art museum. We have the Barnes Collection. Those of you who are in favor or love impressionistic paintings, it's a new museum. You ought to take a trip over there. Of course, we have always the historic area in Center City, but out this way, we have the Franklin Institute. For those of you who are scientists or would like to follow scientists, I think the Franklin Institute right now has a spy exhibit, how spies pass their information along. There is the Academy of Natural Sciences. If you're into the Jurassic period, you may get to see a T-Rex skeleton. Further down the parkway, of course, is the Rodin Museum, and at the very end, the Art Museum. Philadelphia is built in that area on the Champs-Élysées in Paris. Every building you see is a replica of some building in Paris as it goes down the Champs-Élysées. The library, and right on down. Also, you will enjoy the culture. Just walk down there. You can go up the steps of the Art Museum. They're 99, so I warn you ahead of time if you want to climb it. If you want to run it tomorrow, please, not tomorrow, but I guess it's Saturday morning, you want to run it, we're going to take you up the top there, and there's the Rocky statue, the most un-art piece of thing that exists in Philadelphia. It's at the Art Museum, but it probably ought not to be. Most of the stuff at the Art Museum is first-rate art. Rocky is not. But you can do the Rocky tour. You can run up the steps and run down if you have the stamina for that. And you should enjoy that. You can walk. Everything's walking distance from the hotel. Any questions you have, we can answer them for you outside here.
I forgot to introduce ourselves. My name is Seamus Carney. The co-chair is Dick Rosen. And we will be tag teaming throughout the 5 days. You will see us throughout at the various places and times. So we're accessible. Just come up and talk to us anytime you want to. I also want to remind you folks that in your goodie bags you got an information packet from the Connie Mack chapter of all places to eat, where to go, the Ted Williams walk. Don't forget to do that. And let me know how it works out, because it would be really interesting. It's basically a pub crawl. And it concludes at the Ted Williams was not a drinker, but the guy walking with him was, and it concludes at one of the famous places in Philadelphia, McGillin's Old Ale House, and it's a plus to stop in there. Also, right near there is the 13th Street restaurant area. You cannot go hungry in Philadelphia. We have more places to eat than you could ever imagine.
I'd also like to let you know that one of our sponsors for this conference is the Philadelphia Phillies. And if you go down to the vendors room, Philadelphia Phillies. all these out of town people are rooting for the wrong teams here. Down in the vendors room, you will find they have a table down there where they're selling T-shirts and all kinds of Phillies merchandise, as well as a place where you can buy tickets to future Phillies games if you want to do that. So please pay them a visit when you're down there, and just tell them where you're from and get something. I expect to see all of you wearing Phillies T-shirts tomorrow.
And I also want to take this opportunity to introduce the planning committee. Anyone who's in the audience who had anything to do at all to planning with the for the convention, please stand up. We hope we did the right job.
We especially want to thank three members of the committee who did yeoman's jobs. Ellen Starowski, Peter Mancuso, and Morris Levin. Peter did the panels, Morris did the journal, and Ellen did all the interns that you see roaming around and all the computers in the room for the presentations were Ellen's responsibility.
And the convention. Every one of you received a packet that includes the pocket schedule.
Wait. I got a message. Hotel management has told me that Big Papi is running amok in the ballroom, busting the phones all over the place. He's smashing out all the house phones, and you should be careful when you go out there, or you're going to have your phone may be taken. But please be careful. More on this later.
And hold on to your cell phones, too. We hope he understands the difference, but you never know. And so I was interrupted about the convention. You'll read about it in the publications that are there. There's the McFarland publication on the convention program as well as the pocket schedule. If you lose the pocket schedule, which always happens, we have extra copies.
Okay. If you have any problems getting around Philly, want restaurants, want to get somewhere, transportation, outside at the registration is what's called the Connie Mack table. We are the Connie Mack chapter, and you should be able to get any kind of information. If you can't find anybody there, grab Seamus or me, and we will definitely be able to help you find your way. There's information for the ball game out there, maps and instructions on how to get to the ball game. We are going to have a lot of people helping us get to the ball game later.
We also especially want to thank three people. Two of them are in the room. They're the people who had this, the chapter, held the chapter together for decades. We want to give a special thank you to them.
Two of them are here. Joe McGillen, who is goes way back as the head of our Connie Mack chapter. Joe, good to see you. Thanks so much for coming by. Kit Christie is also over there. He's was president of Sabre many years ago, as well as being our guiding spirit throughout these many years. Joe Dittmar also, but he is unable to be here today, but he was the three people we want to pay tribute to.
No, not right now. No, I'll do it. I'm going to do honor the passing. Every organization has people who are no longer with us from the previous year. I want to do something to honor their presence. I'm hoping I can ask you folks to do a moment of silence, and then coming out of the moment of silence, if you would gladly help me lead a chorus of Take Me Out to the Ball Game to further honor their loss. Thank you. And now, one, two, three. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever come back, 'cause it's root for the home league. If they don't win, it's a shame, 'cause it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Thank you. The person who wrote that song was a Philadelphian.
Yes,
thank you. I want to thank the person who came the furthest from home, Nick Gott from Canberra, Australia.
Wow.
Don't forget the variety show, which is on Saturday. We hope we're going to do a pioneering effort to entertain baseball culture and arts.
Now, without further ado, let me introduce to you our speaker for the for this morning. He is a homegrown Philadelphian, went to high school in Penn Charter in Philadelphia, and has been in Philadelphia for many years. He started out kind of, this is a true rags to riches story, I guess. David started with Phillies in sales and group tickets. Scott Palmer told me that he started out with Richie Ashburn selling tickets in those early years of Ashburn's, I guess, tenure as announcer, and then became marketing director, executive vice president, chief operating officer, and then became involved in the Phillies' ownership in 1994. I would prefer to have him tell you about his history and where he's been and how he got there. So I will turn the program over to David Montgomery, the president of the Philadelphia Phillies.
Thank you, and good morning, everybody. And as Dick indicated, I am a lifelong Philadelphian. So for those of you that aren't local, welcome to my city. This is a very passionate sports town, which is great if you happen to work in sports. For the most part, it's great. There can be moments that it presents a challenge or two. But, you know, I really enjoyed the opportunity that I had yesterday to look through this program book. Oh, let me put a disclaimer up front. I will probably put out a couple facts here, and I understand there's great fact checkers in the room. So please do not hesitate. If I have the wrong year, the wrong date, just stand up and correct me, because I know that's where everybody feels comfortable, so I invite you to do that. But, you know, I was noticing this, and first of all, I was amazed to see that 1974, which was a very good Phillies year, was the last year that this convention was held in Philadelphia. Why was it a particularly good Phillies year? Well, we had a young second baseman join the club by the name of Dave Cash, and he had a slogan that he actually wore on a medal around his neck that said, "Yes, we can." And Dave Cash's infusion into our clubhouse was a turning point for our club. And from 1975 through 1983, we enjoyed a wonderful period of success. We had 9 straight winning seasons. 5 times we won the NL East, and twice got to the World Series and won it once. And for those of you that are doing numbers, and I think we had a 56 winning percentage during that period of time. Well, believe it or not, we just repeated that in the 9 years prior to last year. We had 9 consecutive winning seasons. We won 5 championships. We ended up in the World Series twice and, of course, won one of those. So for those of you that follow the cycles in our sport, apparently there is such a thing here in Philadelphia. Another thing I noticed when I looked at this, there was a quote in there that said, "It's amazing what people have discovered." I think that's one of the adages for this group, and I discovered a few things myself. I was 4 years of age in 1950, and you know, I do have, because I've been told about it, I've had memory time and again of Ashburn throwing out, who was a Dodger, he threw out at home plate? Thank you. One answer, who was right here? Thank you. What was the name? Carl Abrams, everybody. Oh, boy, oh, boy. There you go. He was the guy that was going to help me. I'm in trouble already with the group. I do know that Dick Sisler hit the home run in the 10th inning, however. You know, I didn't have time to look up who was the runner that Richie threw out at the plate. But at any rate, what was significant about that? Well, as a young fan, guess what happened in my household in Philadelphia? We got a television. First television in the Montgomery household came in September of 1950, so we could watch the World Series. But what I learned in reading was that we lost. We had a 5-game lead with 5 to play. I did not remember that. We managed to lose 4 of those, and of course won that last day of the season, as we were just talking about. Another thing that I noticed in here that I wasn't aware of is how early promotions in this city started. I believe that there's a gentleman that's going to talk about Dave Cobble. Is that how you pronounce it? Dave Cobble, who dropped the ball from the top of Billy Penn's hat here in City Hall. I think it's some 500 feet. Somebody will tell me exactly. 500 feet to the floor. And I'll tell you what that reminded me of. In 1971, my first year at the Phillies, Bill Giles had hired me, and Bill was brought to Philadelphia by the Carpenter family because we were moving in from Connie Mack Stadium, previously named Shy Park. I know we have some Shy Parks and some Connie Mackers in the room. But the reality is, as a young man that saw most of his games at that ballpark from the mid-50s on, it was Connie Mack Stadium for me. So forgive me if I always refer to it as Connie Mack. But we had just come from Connie Mack Stadium, and it was now opening day in the new ballpark at Veterans Stadium. And Bill was very anxious to find a dramatic way to open every season. He grew up in Cincinnati. His dad was a general manager of the Reds before he became National League president. And he was convinced that you needed to start the year with a bang. So that year, the decision, this was before, for those local people in the audience, this was before we started to bring a series of kite men into Philadelphia. But we dropped a ball from the Atlantic Richfield, Arco helicopter. And we asked Mike Ryan to catch that ball. And my guess is the distance would have been at least as high as Billy Penn because they didn't want to bring the helicopter in hovering too close to the fan base there in a packed ballpark. Well, 2 days prior to that, a fellow by the name of Paul Callahan, who worked with me, the two of us were the guinea pigs to go out there and try to catch the ball from the helicopter. And just a word of advice, if you do this, make sure when they drop the ball, they put a rotation on it. If they drop it without rotation, it's a 600 or 700 foot knuckleball. And there is no way you can catch it. And so for those of you that bump into Irish Mike Ryan anymore, who successfully caught the ball, practice makes perfect. And you should feel that you have some knowledge as to how that event took place. And I've talked a little bit about ballparks here. The way I'd like to break this up, a little bit of suggestion was the game today versus the game when I started, and I will do that in a moment. And I guess it's a good place to start. You know, a lot of people refer to the teams in the 50s as sort of a golden era of baseball. And, you know, as a young fan growing up, I understand that feeling because of the names that I think of, the Mays, Mantle, Snyders, Aarons, Matthews, Musials. You notice there's a little bit of a National League bias with me. Also, you know, Al Kaline, who was probably my favorite American League player as a young man growing up. Roberto Clemente, who clearly became my non-Philly number one as far as a National League player. But what was amazing when I thought back about following the sport back in those days, there were 16 teams, obviously. Those of us that followed it closely could just about name all the lineups. We had the ability, because there wasn't a whole lot of change of uniforms during that period, to identify, well, you know, I know who plays, you know, who that outfielder for the 57 Braves is, et cetera, with Billy Brute and Will Covington. Everybody knows who they are, but in this room at least. At any rate, the point is that's the way we identified it, and our ability to follow it came from the fact that we picked up a newspaper, poured over box scores in the morning, and occasionally got to watch it on TV. Televised games in Philadelphia at that period were pretty much limited to weekend games. And for the most part, then we followed the game on radio. And so those of us that were allowed to listen at night did so. Those of us that weren't took that transistor or whatever and still tried to listen and pay attention to the ball club. I was lucky enough in those Connie Mack years to be a fan, and a couple memories, one of which was jogged again by the program book, because I had the distinct pleasure, and I'll need help on the year here, but on May 13th, either in 53 or 54, I believe, first game I remember attending, a fellow by the name of Robin Roberts took the mound, gave up a leadoff home run, and in this case it was to Bobby Adams, for my friend over here, and second baseman for the Reds at that time, and then retired the next 27 in order. So it's just games that, you know, stick into your memory bank. I had the pleasure, probably the wrong word, I had the opportunity to watch the opposition throw two no-hitters against us. I remember being in the left field at Connie Mack the day that Sandy Koufax no-hit the Phillies. It was a nothing-nothing game, as I remember it. Chris Short was matching him, not with a no-hitter going, but a shutout going. And we were sitting in the upper deck in left field. Frank Howard was the hitter. And all of a sudden, this ball started coming towards us, and it kept coming. And the next thing you know, it went over us and bounced off the signage on top of the roof in left field at Connie Mack Stadium. That's the day that Sandy, I believe it was part of a doubleheader, Sandy Koufax threw a no-hitter. And then in April of 1969, I saw somebody who I got to know in baseball years later, Bill Stoneman, throw a no-hitter against the Phillies. Fortunately, in recent years, we've done more of the no-hitting at home as opposed to the opposition. I think the only one in my years at a combination of Veterans Stadium and Citizens Bank Park by the opposition was Pascual Perez, and his was a rain-short no-hitter, so we kind of discount that one a little bit. And then the other moment as a fan that I distinctly remember was I happened to be there. I was indeed there when Chico Ruiz stole home. Chico Ruiz stole home with Frank Robinson as a hitter, and that was game one of a 10-game losing streak that was a big part of the sad September of 1964 for the Phillies when they lost 10 in a row. So lucky me. The point of this is that before ever getting into the game that I've enjoyed so much, I was truly a fan, had the opportunity, lived near Connie Mack, grew up in the Roxborough section of Philadelphia, probably a 20-minute ride to the ballpark, whatnot, and I don't know, on average, probably I would have attended between 15, 20 games a year right throughout from the time I was probably 6 or 7 going with my dad through the time that we finished our occupancy there in 1970. One of the things you learn as far as numbers that's a little interesting is the fact that ballparks apparently in Philadelphia for the Phillies have a bit of a useful life. We happened to spend, we came to Connie Mack Stadium, left Baker Bowl in, I think it was July 4th, a matter of fact, of 1938, and then spent 32 and a half seasons at Connie Mack Stadium, and we were 33 years at Veterans Stadium before moving to Citizens Bank Park. I again have a bias, but I think we'll be at Citizens Bank Park longer than 33 years, at least I hope so. I won't dwell on it quickly, but a big element, obviously, in change for our ball club was the ballpark location, moving into it. There are several in the room, familiar faces that I've talked to about this. We really decided in 1991, I guess, that we wanted to get more active in managing Veterans Stadium. It was a city-owned stadium. There were concerns about its upkeep and whatnot. And we started to discuss with the city taking over the management of the facility in a way that we could exert more influence on things such as concession decisions, parking, et cetera, all sorts of elements. And then we happened to wander down to Baltimore and changed our mind. And we saw Camden Yards and decided at that point that our focus had to be on trying to get a new baseball-only facility here in Philadelphia. Turned out to be a long journey. Turned out that we had a lot of advice as to where it should be sited. When we asked our fans, interestingly enough, they almost 70 to 75% always said, we like what's happening in the sports complex, and we would encourage you to stay there if at all possible. It turned out that we were able to, along with the Eagles, both develop facilities there. And I think it's one of the things that makes the Philadelphia sports scene unique, that all four professional sports teams are playing, one inside the city, so that we're generating the revenue that we do generate, whether it's the parking, amusement tax, liquor per drink tax, et cetera, is flowing back to our city as opposed to being spread around. The state obviously gets some tax benefits as well. But we're all there within a 3 or 4 block area, And I've always felt that the benefit of that is that if one team's going well and a fan comes in February to see a hockey game or a basketball game and they enjoy the experience, then hopefully they'll be back to see us come summer and baseball season. You know, one thing when I reflected in some of the changes back then about that golden era, at least, I don't remember people talking about competitive balance back then. Didn't the Yankees win like 11 out of 14, during that period when, it seemed like Whitey Ford was in postseason year in and year out with Mantle and Yogi and et cetera. One of the changes when I think about the elements of change between then and now. It's the area that I probably was most involved with when I first joined the Phillies, and that, as Dick pointed out, was involved with ticket sales. That's where I started with the Phillies. I started in February of 1971. We were 2 months away from opening a new ballpark, and the fact was that Bill Giles at the time was looking for somebody to help sell season tickets. We had indicated that maybe we'd move into the new ballpark after the All-Star game the year before. It wasn't ready. We had some people that had signed up in 1970 for tickets, and that duty sort of fell my way. But I reflect as how excited we were in 1971. We drew 1,511,000 fans that first year at Veterans Stadium. Well, that doesn't sound like such a special number today. And everybody talks about the golden period in the 50s and 60s. In 1969, our next to last year at Connie Mack, we drew 519,000 people. To put that in perspective, we're doing that well at Lehigh Valley. We're actually doing better than that right now at AAA up at Lehigh Valley. So a lot has happened, and part of it has been attendance. We only drew 3 million 1 year at Veterans Stadium, and that was the 93 season. We have alums in from that season, and I think those of you who are getting to the ballpark, and I hope you get an opportunity to see Citizens Bank Park tomorrow night, but those of you that will, you'll be part of our Wall of Fame ceremony where we're honoring Curt Schilling this year, and past Wall of Fame winners will be in attendance along with a number of our alums, and then Saturday night the focus is on the 93 team because obviously it's a 20-year anniversary of that. So we had some very good years at the Vet. From the mid-70s, I think we were between 2.5 to 2.7 million fans. And then, lo and behold, moving to Citizens Bank Park, and the numbers changed again. And we've been very, very fortunate. Fan support has been phenomenal for us. And the first year we went in, we drew 3,250,000 fans. And the last few years, we've even topped that. This year will probably be our seventh consecutive season to draw over 3 million fans. So in comparison to those golden years, the numbers are dramatically different as far as the fans are following the sport. Another area that I thought about, which I've had some involvement with certainly recently, is game sponsorship. I talked about the way when I was a young fan, the games were primarily on the weekend. The way Phillies games were sponsored in the 50s, 60s, and almost right into the early 70s, is that three sponsors primarily took three innings. We had a beer, Ballantyne Beer. We had a gas company, Atlantic Richfield. And actually, the other set split between Tasty Baking Company, makers of Tasty Cake here locally, and a product that I don't see much anymore, Philly Cigars, that was part of it. But those were our sponsors. And so our rights holder at the time had to manage those three or four relationships. Bill Giles got involved in selling sponsorships for us in the 70s, and probably that number grew to about, maybe he had 12 different sponsors that he was dealing with at the time that were our major sponsors. We had picked up Girard Bank as a banking sponsor. At that point, AB had replaced Schmitz, who had replaced Ballantyne as our beer, et cetera. And now, to give you a sense, we control all of our sponsorship. By that I mean we sell our own radio, television advertising, premium days, promotion days and whatnot, the affiliation with those, signage in the ballpark. And That group, probably managed by a fellow by the name of Dave Buck, probably has about 12 to 14 employees alone, and we're seeing somewhere in the neighborhood of about 125 customers a year that have a relationship with us in one way or another. So, boy, has it changed in the way of sponsorship sales. Another thing that occurred to me is the changes that have taken place for us, in the way that we've had minor league affiliations. I mentioned our franchise in Lehigh Valley a few minutes ago. You know, the reality is that we have clustered our minor league clubs. Right now, we have Lehigh Valley in the Allentown, Bethlehem, Easton area. I better mention all three. That's our AAA facility. We have the Reading Fighting Phils. They've renamed themselves this year to put those fightings in there. And the Fighting Phils have been an affiliate with us since 1968, pretty amazing length of time. So that's one we've had for a long time. Our high A is in Lakewood, New Jersey, up in the Toms River area. Again, a tremendous franchise for South Atlantic League, has done very well from an attendance standpoint. And then our other local club, not quite as close, is up in Williamsport, which of course is a bit of a baseball hotbed for other reasons. And from a club that used to have teams out in Helena, Montana, and Bend, Oregon, and Oklahoma City, and you name it, we were spread all over the country. It has sure made sense for us to make this change. Two reasons. From a business standpoint, we believe that if somebody sees Cody Ashe, who just joined us last night, somebody sees Cody play at both Reading and Lehigh Valley, then, you know, if they've developed some affinity for him, perhaps they're willing to come to Citizens Bank Park to see them here. Another business reason, the cost of transporting players. We can get players like Cody Ashe here in hours as opposed to flying them from one coast to another as we had to in the past. But really, from a baseball ops standpoint, it's been spectacular. It gives all of our player development people the chance to move from one minor league club to another. All our roving instructors, player movement is easy. And of course, the other place where we have two teams, we have our Florida State League opportunity down in Clearwater, which is also where we host Gulf Coast. That leads me to another area of significant change, and that's spring training. Spring training has become so important to all of our franchises. The movement around, when I look in the old days, as to where the Phillies would train from year to year and bounce all over the place, and the realization that, in discussion with Dallas Green and Paul Owens in years past, with them describing that, yeah, the big league club was training in Clearwater, but the AAA club was somewhere in North Carolina, and the AA club was in Georgia, et cetera. They came up with the concept to develop Carpenter Complex, which was a multi team training facility, four fields with a clubhouse in the middle. And the concept that they developed in 1969, believe it or not, still exists today. With the help of the city of Clearwater, it's been embellished several times over, including most recently this past year. But the reality is now we have our ballpark and our spring training facility side by side. It's pretty special in our industry. You want your spring training site to be a magnet for both players and fans. And one of the things that's happening player preparation-wise is if you make nice facilities, the players are much more likely to go there earlier. They're much more willing to, have supervision for any of their workouts or whatnot, rather than be spread around the country and doing individual work. That's all part of probably one of the biggest on-field changes, which I think is game preparation. The time that players spend in our clubhouse has gone up exponentially. And so as a result, we feed them not just one, often not just two, but sometimes as many three meals a day. We're much more into nutrition. It's not the cheesesteaks and the offerings of Philadelphia night in and night out to players. We try to do that in the visiting. No, I'm teasing. But the reality is that the whole game preparation has changed. I mean, the emphasis on weight room, our training facilities, our batting cages, video. Comparison, quick comparison, 1971, the year I joined the Phillies, value engineered out was the 360 service level drive around. In other words, the original design of the ballpark had a service tunnel all the way around so you could come in the right field corner, which was always called the truck ramp, and then take trucks, buses, et cetera, all the way around. Cost of doing that, excavating and whatnot, caused that to be value engineered. So they did a halfway around, and the concept was you would pull the bus in, drop off the fillies, if, you know, and then go to the turnaround, bring the visiting club in, et cetera. Absolutely solid concept. Opening day, 1971, the Montreal Expos came to the vet. The bus, he dropped them off probably, I think it was a 105 start that day, if memory serves me correct. So I'm going to guess he pulled in a little after 9 to drop them off. He was still turning it around in the third inning. So we, so what happened, that space was never again used for a bus or a truck turnaround. It became our batting cage as an afterthought. And now, you know, the first thing you do in designing a ballpark is, you know, how many home cages are you going to have? What's the concept for the visiting cages, et cetera? And probably the other major development in preparation is the use of video. All players now, many, I mean, Chase Utley would be an excellent example in our club, they just can't get enough video. They just want to see who they're facing that night, what's he throwing, let me see my last 10 at-bats, let me see when I had success against him 2 years ago, how did he get me out the last time, whatever. And video rooms literally are within a stone's throw of the dugout now. So occasionally, if you look in a dugout and you wonder, where did so-and-so go? He went back underneath. Oftentimes, both pitchers and hitters, but hitters in particular, are back in there looking at their last at-bat, trying to understand what happened, what he threw, et cetera. I want to leave plenty of time for questions, so let me just shorten these last two. I've been asked from time to time, you know, what are the challenges facing our sport? And I think the challenge, not just for our sport, for all sports, is to be able to keep the game attended experience to be attractive enough that it offsets what the opportunity is to watch our games on television. With the advent of high def, with the advent of what, 7 different replay locations, with the opportunity to see players and managers, you know, coaches, et cetera, interviewed in game, everybody's time is probably their most precious commodity. And so you worry about the commuting time, you worry about the time to exit a parking lot, because what you want to do is have the ballpark experience still be number one. And you know, I don't think it's a unique challenge, as I said, for baseball. I think it's a challenge for all of us. I mean, a good example of the way people value their time, 1970s through mid-80s, we always scheduled probably 3 or 4 twinight doubleheaders. Oh, boy, this is 2 for the price of 1. You know, what could be better? That's the way I felt, than spend not just 3.5 hours at a ballpark. You can get there, you know, spend 7 hours. And, you know, the reality is the appeal of that just doesn't exist. I mean, you know, there are certain markets, our fans hang in pretty well as far as getting there early at the start of the game, but it's amazing how many are getting in first, second, third inning, and how many will say, well, depending upon how things are going, you know, look at traffic situation and whatnot and leave early. So we really have to pay attention, as do all sports, to make sure that we're doing things at the ballpark to make it attractive. You know, our tools for that is try to be a broader audience. This is a hardcore group of baseball fans, for the most part, seated here in front of me. They're the type of people that I remember sitting and watching a game with Bart Giamatti, and we had a great discussion as to why a scoreboard was needed. You know, a fan of vision, I shouldn't say, not a line score. You know, Bart was of the opinion the game itself was beautiful. You know, the less distractions, the better. But the reality, not all of us absorbed the game the way Bart Giamatti did. And, you know, the fact is, whether it's a use of a fanatic, whether it's a use, somebody outside, we were talking about diverse concession menus as opposed to what it was, whether it's premium items to attract young fans, whether it's heritage nights, fireworks, the list goes on and on. The reality is that we want to try to have as broad-based experience as possible to attract people to come. The last thing that I would talk about as far as a factor of important to a club's success in a city, and I believe this is true not only at the big league level, but also very true at the minor league level, and that's community involvement. I mean, we are the Philadelphia Phillies, and as a result, we feel that we are not representing just our ball club, but our city, and we feel that when there are issues that are important to our city, whether it's times of tragedy, whether it's opportunities to support nonprofit organizations, etc., that's part of the challenge of being a very visible entity in your community. And we've been lucky for the most part. A number of our players have followed that as well. And I think that and right now we're going through a tough stretch. You know, normally I don't go out in public when we've lost the day before, let alone when we lost 8 out of the last 9. So I committed to this a long time ago. I had no idea I was going to, I walked in and my friend, I don't know where he's seated right now, but he was giving me advice in the men's room, telling me, there he is, I understand, but that man has the passion that we're looking for and the interest in the club, and we appreciate that, and we know there's a lot of passion and interest in the room, so I'm going to stop for a moment, and with the help of Scott Palmer, see if there's any questions. I've been told the room is not bashful, so we have about 15 minutes or so. Yes, sir. I may need somebody on the mic, too. Go ahead. Go ahead. Slide behind him, sir, so you're ready to go.
Okay, this has to do with competitive balance.
Okay.
It seems to me, since we went to 3 and now even 4 rounds of playoffs in the last 12 years or so, an organization, if it spends enough money, can buy an excellent chance of getting into the playoffs. But my reading of it is that it's just about impossible to really give yourself a superior chance of getting into the World Series nowadays, because baseball is an unpredictable game and these series are short. And my question to you really is that the way your organization thinks? Maybe you wouldn't put it that way, and other organizations think. In other words, we want to be good enough to win in the low 90s and get in the playoffs, but really, beyond that, it's too unpredictable to worry about.
Well, yes and no, and I'll explain that real quickly. The yes is they absolutely believe that the goal is to be one of those now 10 participants. If you're one of those 10 participants, you hold the fan interest in everything, and we thought we were still in the hunt to be one of those as recently as 10 days ago. That's a whole other story. But but the reason I said yes and no, at the same time, we have morphed into a pitching-dominated club. We're not pitching particularly well this year, but we got the starters to position us to do that because we thought those starters would be helpful in giving us success in the short series. So the answer is, I agree with you entirely that the goal, I think, for most franchises right now is if we can be in a position to get in, that's success. And once you're one of those 10 in, anybody has a chance. Now, we've set it up in a way that those 2 wild cards don't have quite the same chance that others do, that's for sure. Last thing I will say, I think it is tougher and tougher to buy success. And what I mean by that, I always use the name Andrew McCutchen just because he's a gifted player and somebody that the Pirates are somebody, frankly, other than the Phillies that I root for. There's a couple markets. I watched games last night, and I was thrilled to see the passion for our game in both Pittsburgh and Cleveland last night because they are 2 very good baseball cities, and it's happening for them at least right now. But the players like Andrew McCutchen, all the good young players now are being locked up a lot earlier. So the ability to go through free agency and acquire these big-name free agents, I don't think exists as much. I'd better go to the next gentleman. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I actually organized the 74 meeting you mentioned, just out of interest. But
okay.
But my question relates to your comments about time. The games take longer to play these days, a lot longer.
Right.
And if you want an experience at the park, what do you think about that?
Well, I will tell you, the commissioner asked me to serve on this on-field committee that he's put together. It's an interesting group. It has 4 current/former managers, actually. It's Joe Torre, Tony La Russa, and our former now, and Jim Leyland and Mike Socha, the current, has 4 GMs and then 4 of us suits or whatever that have some history in the game. And we are constantly concerned, and that's a group that's studying instant replay. And the real fear of instant replay is to get everything right in our game is going to take time. It's going to take time, and we're just not sure to go to that degree. It's a good cost-benefit analysis. Love to get hitters, as they used to never step out of the box. talked about it incessantly. But players, when they get to the big league level, have developed habits, and boy, those habits are tough to break. So it's absolutely emphasis to try to get these games to 2.5 hours or less if possible. Yes, sir.
As a lifelong Red Sox fan.
Red Sox fan, all right.
I have a very strong connection, and I want to thank you, the Phillies, for bringing back one of my heroes, Pedro Martinez, for his final hurrah.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you if you had anything to say about Pedro.
Well, you know, we were very fortunate. I think that one was almost personal in the sense that Ruben Amaro had developed a relationship with Pedro and talked to him, and, you know, it was... he felt that at that point a full season was a bit much for him, and you know, we were in need at the right time, and he was different than probably you would see him as a fan. We became to feel about Pedro the way a Red Sox fan would feel about him, as opposed to maybe some of the opposition that he faced, because you know he had so much success against people. So he was a good acquisition for us. Enjoyed having him.
Thanks.
Montreal. Parc Géry.
Parc Géry, no?
Right. I love that ballpark. Okay. That was a special ballpark. I used to go up there every year in the early 70s. Go ahead, you have a question.
I'm still grieving,
yes.
By the way. And actually, my question relates to that very subject, because I know that there is a movement afoot among some people in Montreal, including former Expo Warren Cromartie,
right,
to try and get a franchise back there. Do you think he's whistling in...
Well,
or is there any possibility? Montreal was a great baseball town, and it can still be one again.
Yeah. So. You know what? And I know we have some of my national media friends here and whatnot. The reality is that I do not hear any discussion of expansion. I will tell you, as somebody that's worked on scheduling and whatnot, we could use some even numbers. We could use some even numbers in divisions and in leagues and whatnot. That would probably make the scheduling process much more efficient. The reality is, though, I don't see momentum headed there. Now, what I can't speak to, from time to time, there have been discussions of certain franchises that aren't enjoying great success, maybe looking for another home. That's another decision entirely. I think, with the benefit of hindsight, there's people in the game that feel it's too bad the sequence of events that developed in Montreal that took, you know, their best season, sadly, was the one that never finished, 1994, and who knows what that would have done, a successful year that would have done to carry the enthusiasm that may have kept the Expos there. So, but I do, as somebody that went up there and can speak on behalf of all our traveling parties, we loved going to Montreal. Yes.
And I just want to repeat the other gentleman's comments about Pedro Martinez.
Okay.
I feel the same way.
There you go. That's right. There were three places Pedro that fans like him. Amen. Pedro's getting a lot of love here. Yes, sir.
You had mentioned that the Phil's becoming pitching dominant team. And that's great, you know, and it's true. We've gotten pretty unlucky with Roy and Cole and all that. But... the thing is, the game has become more pitching dominated, and so it's an interesting conundrum you have here, because I think the Phillies don't have enough, don't have enough hitting.
We don't. We agree.
Don't enough hitting. I don't know how else to say
it. I'll say it for you. We're not scoring enough runs. Don't worry about insulting me.
But I also think when you start to develop players like Cody Ash or like Mikiel Franco, or the new Crawford, my feeling is you have to look into other things besides just batting average. You have to look into things like OPS, like WAR, and all that. And are the Phillies finally doing stuff?
Yeah,
when
you say finally, I think there's a misconception. I think we have a lot of emphasis on statistical analysis, but we have been known for a club that believes in scouting. And I don't see those two things to be mutually exclusive, and that's not how we operate. I mean, we basically, if there was one stat, I think we would probably say we use weighted on base percentage. In other words, taking into account the, you know, extra base hits and weighting it accordingly as a primary tool. don't always judge our desire by our acquisitions. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, people say, well, look at that. Look who they took. Don't they know this player can't do X and Y? Yeah, but we happen to think he's better than who we have playing there. And so even though he doesn't have the tools that fit some of the people in the room, we know that. But we see that player to be maybe a defensive player that's better. I mean, Ben Revere's an example that way. It's a shame we lost Ben because he was becoming more accustomed to playing center field. He hadn't played much center field. He was developing some center field instincts and whatnot. But we definitely are using those tools along with scouting. I will say this on scouting. We believe in character. And statistics don't always take you to character. Pat Gillick, for example, who's still with us, believes strongly if before he would sign somebody, he'd want to have lunch with him. He'd want to sit down with them for at least an hour or so and talk to them and understand where their head is and what their interest is. And, you know, if they would be somebody that we're envisioning switching a position, would they be receptive to that? Or are they going to say, no, that's not where I want to be? Or if they're at the end of their career, would they accept a part-time role? Or would they resist it and whatnot? And so those are the reasons that we try to combine both scouting and analytical analysis. Better go to the man behind you. Sox?
On a lighter note,
yes.
The Philly Fanatic, can you tell us about its origins?
Yeah, that's real easy, and I'll make it as brief as I can because many in the room have heard it that are local. But, you know, the reality is that we had two people, one who works for the Cleveland Indians right now, Dennis Lehman, who's their senior business person, and Chris Wheeler, who was a broadcaster that traveled with a club in the late 70s, came back and said to Bill Giles, you know, this San Diego chicken is catching on out there. We should think about it. Bill God bless him, because he hired me quickly. He's a quick decision maker. And he said, we should get a mascot, and we should get one of the best we can. And he indicated that we should go to the Muppets people at the time to see if they would design a character. He had an idea, wanted it to be sort of nondescript, roly-poly, etc. But beyond that, left it up to quote-unquote the experts. The Henson people told us to go to Harrison Erickson, which was a design firm that they used. They came back, designed the costume. We were very fortunate. We've only had two people actually perform on the field in the costume. David Raymond was the original, Tom Burgoyne since 1993. David Raymond, we didn't know it. He was working as an intern for us. We grabbed him, put him in the uniform. He was athletic. He could dance. And incredibly enough, his mom also was deaf, and he did a lot of speaking, communicating with her through mime and gesture. And I think the combination of Dave's athleticism, Harrison Erickson's design and whatnot led to the successful character that is now in his, 36th year with us or something like that. So pretty special. So thank you.
Great story. Thank you.
Sure thing. Yes, sir.
My question goes back to pitching.
Okay.
Yours
isn't as light as the last one.
No. No, this goes back when you first started with the Phillies.
Oh, okay.
How many times over the years have you kind of privately or just happy that Gussie Bush was too cheap to sign Steve Carlton?
Well,
and then quite frankly made the Phillies the team they were in the 70s and early 80s with Carlton as the anchor of the staff. And of course we got Rick Wise. I'm a Cardinals fan.
Well, so, you know, I had a strong feeling you were a Cardinals fan. I could deduce that. And I will tell you, you know, the interesting thing, those of us that worked in the office, and I had been there 1 year at the time, the trade took place late in spring training of 72. And it was over a contract dispute, as you've correctly identified. And Paul Owens came in and told us we just traded Rick Wise. Well, Rick Wise, the previous year, believe it or not, he was a very good pitcher for us. He was our most marketable commodity. He had thrown that no-hitter where he hit two home runs in a game out in Cincinnati and whatnot. And we were, what? You traded? We can sell Rick Wise. And of course, Carlton just took us to a whole nother level. And Rick still comes back. Lefty's in this weekend, and there's no question. I mean, his competence and what he did for us absolutely took us there. So we do thank the Cardinals for their generosity.
Yeah, that wasn't a good decade for the Cardinals in the 70s.
I totally have time for one more question, unfortunately. Hi, Dave.
I'm a Phillies season ticket holder.
Thank you.
I'm from your peer group, let's put it that way.
All right.
But I have a real problem with the Major League Baseball schedule, particularly the Phillies schedule. I didn't care for it this year at all. I thought that the whole interleague play thing is being force-fed to us. I don't like the concept of the two-game series. I don't care for that. I didn't care for opening up with an American League team. I wanted the local team. The standings today don't mean anything. We spent a good bit of the first part of the season on the road, not playing the two teams in the division that are arguably the best. You can't look at the standings any longer and figure out who's where. You got to see how many games left against who. Whereas back in the day, back in the old eight-team league, you always knew pretty much where you were because there were swings that went up geographically and things kind of stayed together. Related to the schedule, I think the interest of Major League Baseball is being put ahead of the local fans is really what I'm trying to get down to. We've had games here in Philadelphia that have been moved to 8 o'clock at night, particularly on Sundays. I'll reference the Phillies Fanatics birthday. It was a disaster in my house where we had a number of children that were supposed to go to this game, and it got pushed to 8 o'clock on a Sunday night. So, that's just how I feel, and I just wanted to talk.
Well, let me respond as follows. I don't disagree with a lot of your comments. The fact of the matter is when we've gone to this 15-15 schedule, it mandates that interleague be played throughout the time. When we came to trying to put a squeeze week into the schedule, the reality is the only place we could put the squeeze week was into interleague. So at that point of time, that's why we're playing the 2-2s this year we did against Boston and the 2-2s that we played against Cleveland. As long as we're playing this format, I can't stand here and tell you anything other than, you're going to see that. Now, we will not be the club that will always open out of the league, although preliminarily next year you may see it again, not at home. But the reality is that, that was a trade-off. And, you are right about national TV, but a Sunday night game, I was reading, in Sports Business Daily, I guess just this morning or yesterday, somebody that is in player development for the NFL was talking about the one appointment TV time he has because he still likes baseball is he watches the Sunday night game of the week. So, the reality is the more popular teams get picked more frequently. We want to remain popular because that's not a good thing for us if we're not nationally popular to be picked from time to time. But that is part of it. There is a limit to the number of times you can be picked, but it's an uncomfortable limit, and I have empathy for you.
What about the balance aspect of the schedule? Where you're
well, the you were referencing, and you're correct. There was a time when it was 12 teams, six in your in each division, and it was very clear. You played 18 and 12. You opened in your division. You played them in the summer, and you finished in your division. And you played the National League West in our case in May, home and away, and then again, late July, early August, and it had a real rhythm to it. I think over time, this is the first year we did this schedule, I think over time you'll see more balance as far as when we play, as you pointed out, we have a lot of inventory left with Atlanta and Washington. I know, maybe too little too late for us this year. I don't disagree. I'm just saying to you. The fact is,
just
I think...
feedback from me, that's really what it is.
Excuse me?
Just feedback, that's all.
No, I understand. Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave.
Steve, we have to end right now.
Thank you very much. The four people in line, I'll be happy to talk to individually, but thank you. Enjoy your time in Philadelphia, and for those of you that aren't Phillies fans, bear with us for a few days, all right? Thank you all.